excellent day for an exorcism.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Every you do, don't fall.
At number 10, it has to be The Changeling. And here is a film that I think is incredibly overrated. Many of my favourite critics pinpoint this one to be a perfect 10 out of 10 ghost story. And I'm not having that. There are fundamental things wrong with this. And they are nothing to do with the dated feel or the dated aesthetics. I've no problem with a movie from 1980 looking like a bygone relic, even when it is released. And as for the haircuts, the clothes, the way in which people speak to each other, and the score, well, I sort of love all that stuff. For this film, anyway. So don't get me wrong, I do own this thing on DVD, I do own it on Blu-ray as well, and I would definitely urge anyone out there that has not seen it to do so. I just don't think it's 10 out of 10. And this is why. The thing that stops me from loving this film and labelling it as this all-time classic is that I just don't believe it. It's the simple things. I don't believe it. And if it was just one thing or just two things, then fine. But there's so many and they build on top of each other until in my head everything crumbles. There's moments on here that are just silly. Even during that opening crash that lays down the very foundations of the whole movie, well, I question the mechanics of it. Even in the snow, things wouldn't play out in that way. Also, George C. Scott does turn in a masterful performance. He's this heartbreaking composer, John Russell, but he takes this lecturing professor type of job in Seattle. It's set up as this major thing. And yet at a certain point in the movie actually forgets about that. He doesn't have to go to work anymore. He becomes this impromptu, self-appointed private investigator. And not only that, there's a point in the film where police are questioning him. A man that discovers a dead body in a house that he's never actually been to. Maybe they would ask a couple of questions. And fair enough, they do. The thing is, he says, nah, dunno. And they're fine with that. He just shrugs his shoulders. They're cool with it in an instant. This film is mad. So that's just three reasons. There is plenty more. I won't go on. So, you may ask, why is it in your top 10 then? Well, I've already mentioned it. It's the performance. And I don't care how drunk he was on set. That performance from George C. Scott and all his reactions to all those ghostly goings on, they're top shelf. This actor can sell a scare, and this film is full of those old-fashioned things that are going bump in the night moments. He is perfect for it. I feel like this is a total cold February night type of film, just right for when this podcast is being released. I would say turn off the lights and snuggle up to whatever loved one you have there, human or non, because this, it's The Changeling.
The stairs and banisters are solid oak. The doors are inlaid with mahogany.
What does it take to maintain a house of this size?
Whether you buy or rent the Chessman House, whatever you do...
John?
Don't go into the attic. The Changeling. Rated R.
Here's your Letterboxd synopsis. Whatever you do, don't go in the attic. After a tragic event happens, composer John Russell moves to Seattle to try and overcome it and build a new and peaceful life in a lonely big house that has been uninhabited for many years. But soon after, the obscure history of such an old mansion and its own past begins to haunt him. Now, as you know, in a year in horror, I'm totally one for hot, hot gossip. And well, while I'm in this salty state of mind, and because I think without George C. Scott, this movie wouldn't be up to too much, let's investigate the power of this man's crotch. So, George C. Scott, he was married 5 times. He's a rogue. He's a cad. And this is a delightful tale. His first marriage was to Carolyn Hughes in 1951, and she had a small role in the fantastic Roger Corman vehicle called The Wasp Woman. They had 1 daughter together. Not Carolyn and Roger Corman. That would be weird. Then, 4 years later, in 1955, he married Patricia Reed, and they had a daughter and a son. Then, in 1959, George's acting roles stepped up. He was gaining success with the likes of The Hanging Tree and Autonomy of a Murder, and at this point, he married Colleen Dewhurst. So we hit 1960 now, and Colleen is the star of The Dead Zone. She's in The Exorcist 3, and the awesome and very underseen movie called When a Stranger Calls. I think horror addicts will know that, but the general person just doesn't. I really would recommend it, especially the opening sort of salvo of that thing, When a Stranger Calls, is class. Anyway, Colleen and George, well, they had two children together, and then they divorced, and then they got remarried again. One of their kids was actor Campbell Scott, and you may know him from the awesome grunge rom-com film called Singles. Plus, I know him very well from The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Then, because he was a bit of a loose cannon at this point, and his pants must have contained a love gun the size of a grenade launcher, well, he married Trish Van Devere, and he met her on the set of The Last Run, which also starred his current wife of that time, Colleen Dewhurst. The Scandal, keep up, please. Now, Trish starred in The Changeling with him, plus she was the lead in the awesomely postered The Hearse. I'm yet to see it, but that poster is something else. Now, I don't know if we should mention at this point that he had another daughter out of wedlock, somewhere amongst all that, but I would just say this. Good job, George C. Scott. What a legacy you've left behind, both with your offspring and your movies. And just a little caveat, I want to put this in here. Mega points as well for playing the culturally inappropriate Native American in the 1984 classic Stephen King adaptation, Firestarter. So many people think that's a boring film, that it's rubbish. At least it's better than the new one. I think I watched that movie around 50 times growing up as a kid. Bloody legend in that he is. Bloody legend. Although, was his performance a little bit patchy? If you've seen it, it took me a little while. Anyway, let's listen to some music. This one is composed by Howard Blake and Rick Wilkins and Ken Wanberg. It's not very clear who did what for this thing, but what is clear is that it's very expensive sounding. I can hear a full orchestra, I swear it, and it's traditionally spooky with it. It's very reminiscent of like those Hammer scores from the late 60s, and this thing just loves the slow build and the screechy payoff. I love those deep drones as well, that when the suspense builds in this film, and there's lots of it. It sounds ridiculously classy, and I'm sorry to harp on about it, but any director that has maybe like a blank check for a budget, and you're going to be filming a traditional haunted house type movie, this is what you want to be matching. My only issue is that there's no iconic moments in it. There's no musical motifs that make you instantly picture a scene or a character. But you can't have it all. Label this one under posh. And where can you watch it? Well, let me tell you. In the UK, you can stream it for nothing. It's on Prime and it's on Shudder. And then in the USA, it's all over the place. It's on Peacock, Plex, Shudder, AMC+, Vudu, Tubi, Screenbox, probably some more. If you want to go into more detail with this one, perhaps, and get some podcast recommendations from me, open up your ear holes, because here we go. I cannot not recommend that you head over to the big one. Evolution of Horror paired this with the Amityville Horror for their February 2018 show in the Ghost Season. And when you've done that, I just think it's going to give you major satisfaction. So, yeah, after that, you can just move on with your life. As an added bonus to that podcast, the actual guest that Mike has on there is special effects wizard Dan Martin, and he has been a regular guest on this show as well. This episode of Evolution of Horror is one of the very best that there is. It's magic. And that is The Changeling. At number 9, here is a Brian De Palma movie. It stars Michael Caine, who plays the psychiatrist Dr. Robert Elliott, and I love the frank conversation that he has at one point in the first act of this one. During one of his sessions, his patient says to him, "Do you find me attractive? Do you want to sleep with me?" To which he says yes. And when she asks, "Well, why doesn't he then?" he just says that he loves his wife and he doesn't want to jeopardize his marriage. That whole scene is masterfully composed. Of course it is. This is prime era De Palma after all. But that still doesn't stop me from thinking, just wow, this is incredible. And then I think that scene's good, but even that scene pales into insignificance when compared to the next one. The character of Kate Miller, she plays this odd game of cat and mouse with a guy in an art gallery, and that game ends up with sex happening in a New York cab and then back at his apartment as well. She goes to do a sneaky walk of shame, but she wants to write him a goodbye note, so she's looking for paper, and when she does, she finds this doctor's letter, and this doctor's letter says that this guy that she's just been with, he's got VD. At this point, I was taken aback by how close to a giallo stereotype that this thing revels itself in. And in my notes, it just says, this is playing like a giallo with a very posh Pino Donaggio score. Anyway, she leaves, but she forgets her wedding ring, so she has to then go back up in the elevator. All the time, the audience is tense. I'm just thinking, is he going to wake up? Is there going to be a scene? It's going to be really awkward. And unfortunately, when she goes back up in the elevator, with all these thoughts of VD in her mind, she just gets herself slashed up by a blonde killer dressed in black with, of course, the accompaniment of black gloves. This film, in part, is stunning for both its weaving of narrative and its style of camera work, and with an eye for what to exactly capture on the screen at what exact moment. This, it's Dressed to Kill.
Brian De Palma, the master of the macabre, invites you to a showing of the latest fashion in murder. Dressed to Kill, Michael Caine, Angie Dickinson, Nancy Allen. Murder, Made to Order by Brian De Palma. Rated R.
Held over for third big week. Check newspapers for theaters and showtimes.
Here's your Letterboxd synopsis, and it goes as thus. A mysterious, tall, blonde woman wearing sunglasses murders one of a psychiatrist's patients. And now she's after the prostitute who witnessed it. Okay, so one of my favourite ever conversations is going to happen right now with Mr. Mark Canali. What he brings to the show is always rather special for me. I always learn something new, or I get to look at something in a different way from when the first time it was that I saw it. This happens all the time when I discuss cinema with him. So let me tell you that this chat about Dressed to Kill, it's no exception. So, let's have at it, shall we? This is myself and Mark chatting during that weird week between Christmas Day and New Year's Day. Welcome back, Mr. Mark Canali. Thank
Hello
you
again.
For coming on.
Hello. Hello, I missed
Hello.
You.
Hello.
Oh, I missed you.
So, this is the big one. Finally, it's not trash. Finally, we're talking about a sensible adult type of film. We're talking about Dressed to Kill today. Before we go into Brian De Palma, which I'm just talking to you a few seconds ago, I'm excited to do. Like, what's your history with this film? Is it something that you watched earlier on? Or because for me, it was the first week I started researching for the podcast, this was a major hole like De Palma stuff except Carrie, I didn't know. So
yeah,
this is what I watched. What about for you?
Well, no, this film, God, no, this film I watched long time ago, probably, I think probably Carrie would have been the first De Palma I watched, and I probably wouldn't have even known it was De Palma at that point in time. You know, it would have been just the case of it was Carrie.
Yeah.
You know, that was, you would have known the film. But once she starts sort of picking up on some bits, you start watching films, and Dressed to Kill was definitely one of those late night movies, late teens probably. And I remember, it's quite funny you saying it's an adult film, which of course, you know, in a lot of regards, yes, it is a adult film, but I think it's the sort of film that you kind of, is probably best enjoyed when you're a teenage boy. I really do think that this film almost is perfectly made for some teenage boys, because it was, I remember someone hated the first 20 minutes. I was like, this is just, you know, it was like that kind of, it's all a bit kind of middle-aged soft porn type.
I watch this with my mum.
I know. Well, it's just like your mum's virtually in it at the beginning. It's like, oh, this is not right. And yeah, but then literally it turns, obviously, at the point, and I think we should say as well, there is no way we can discuss this film in any way without completely blowing it, you know, without completely ruining it. You just can't talk about characters without talking about who they are in the film, and that's kind of the big reveals in it. So I think, you know, if you're gonna, if you haven't watched it, yeah, spoiler warning, if you're gonna watch it and you want to watch it and you haven't watched it, do it now, kind of thing, because this is going to be all over the place, this discussion with stuff. But yeah, that 20 minutes in, you get the first killing, and it comes out of nowhere, kind of thing. You can tell there's a build up to stuff, but you're not expecting it to be what actually happens. And that completely knocked my socks off at the time. That was like, okay, I can remember being like, wow, okay, this is interesting.
It does that psycho thing, though. Then that's it for that bit.
Yes, the lead character, the top, you know, the one of the top actors, you know, in it, gets knocked off 20 minutes in. Yeah, of course it's psycho. We'll come to De Palma and all of his Hitchcocky and stuff. But, you know, yes, he basically liked the idea of it. Why not? And he did it. So, yeah, and it knocked my socks off. And I'd seen Psycho by that time. I probably didn't relate it directly to it when I was watching the beginning. It happened. I didn't sit there, it happened, and thought, oh, come on, De Palma, really? You know, I just watched and was like, what? What are you doing? And then Keith Gordon comes in with his character, and Keith Gordon's character was like, that's the kind of character that I would then be like, ah, right, okay, I can suddenly connect with a character in a film like this. It's not all going to be a little bit kind of soft focus, erotic, you're a bit kind of like, ugh. So here was like a mystery. Here was like, and this is one of your characters that's going to try and solve the mystery. Great. I'm in.
I am exactly the same as you. Like, I don't get me wrong. I do like to see naked women in the shower, I guess, if we're going to go
this
there.
This is the film there. For you.
Yeah. You know, and just like the beginning of Carrie, like, was it Carrie the one before? No, it was a few before, I think.
No, it was a few before.
But yeah, so it just like that, we're starting in the shower, it's very steamy, but this time we're seeing actual vagina, and I just thought, like you, like, as I said, this is an adult film. Like,
yes.
What am I into? I don't know if I like it. It's, as you say, soft focus, and then Arnie Cunningham from Bloody Christine, like, as
exactly.
You say.
Exactly, exactly. You would have related to that. Yeah, exactly. I recognize him from Jaws too, because, you know, that's going to be one of my big reference points. So, you know, I loved him from Jaws 2. And yeah, he's straight in. I also loved him. I probably liked him from a film I would have seen before, because it's one of my teenage favorites. And it was a bizarro little movie that probably, again, only teenage boys would think it was like this really amazing art house film called Static, which came out in 1985. And I remember catching that on late night TV when I was young, and it blew my mind. I, you know, not being that exposed to kind of art house cinema, that kind of movie was just, and it had this amazing soundtrack with Viva and Japan and Brian Eno. And it, you know, and it was like, just, what is this? And he played a character in that, again, another, as he always would do, because he was going to be typecast. Yeah. You know, he played another nerdy, kind of slightly creepy character.
I can't wait. I don't know that. I think I don't know that.
It's not really a genre film. It's more a kind of weird drama kind of thing, but it's very good. I think it's a really good film, and you'd love the soundtrack on it.
This is the thing. When I get into an actor, I'm not really bothered about what genre it is.
Yeah.
It has to be something that will pull me into an outside of a horror or a sci-fi film. It really does.
Yeah, it's just a quirky little thing. Yeah, no, it is definitely worth a watch, I think, yeah.
Well, let's move back to the director, Brian De Palma. Mm-hmm. Straight away, for me, this film just looks posh, as we've mentioned, and it's a real elegance to his film craft, I think. Even like now when I watch Sisters, that's the sort of stuff, like those shots, I'm just like, do you know what? I can tell his work now. What's your De Palma? Is he someone that, like Spielberg for me, like as soon as I watch Jaws, you know, I want to watch all his other films. Did that happen here?
Yes. De Palma to me was a little bit of an addiction for a while. Yeah, it was a case of once I sort of cottoned on to who this guy was and what he did. Yes, there were a lot of films, maybe not necessarily like literally one after the other, but you know, you started to sort of pick up, oh, here's a De Palma, you know, he's in the DVD store, you know, in Blockbuster or something. Oh, that's a De Palma, okay. Or one comes on TV, oh, it's him, I'm watching that, I haven't seen that before. And you know, even now, there are films sometimes, I, you know, you'll suddenly one of his lesser known ones, and I'll sort of be like, oh, I haven't even heard of that one. And you watch it, and it just kind of blows your mind again, just because every time you watch a particular one of his films, it's just, he just does that to me, kind of blows my mind a little bit. And I love that, you know, his films to me are just really entertaining, no matter the content. You know? If you know what I mean.
Do you know his comedies? Like, there's one called Home Movies and one called Wise Guys that I've not seen. Oh my God.
I haven't seen Wise Guys. No, I mean, he started off doing comedy. That was his first thing he did in the late 60s, maybe even early 70s. He cast Robert De Niro in his first starring role in a comedy. It's apparently not a great one. But I have seen Home Movies. I actually watched that one because it's one of his Keith Gordon ones.
All right.
And it's the one that was made before this one. It was literally the film he made before this. So pretty much at one of his peaks, you know, one of his sort of filmmaking popularity peaks. And it is horrible. Best way I can describe it. I mean, really bad. I think when he puts comedy into his kind of thrillers, I think quite often it hits. I think it works quite nicely because he's very good at creating tension. He's very good at doing that. And so I think when he puts little bits of comedy in, they're nice little releases. And I find myself kind of chuckling quite a bit at the little sort of comedic bits that pop up in his films. But when he tries to do comedy, let's put it this way, I don't think he has a natural talent at doing it. I don't think he would ever have become famous doing comedy films.
There is a stack that I love. So, I mean, just before we came on, we were chatting about a bit of his filmography. And, like, I just want to run down some of these, if I may. So between 72 and 87, I think it's quite an insane filmography of hits. And I don't know, we'll go through anyone you want to pick out afterwards. So I've got written down here, we've got Sisters, Phantom of the Paradise, Obsession, Carrie, The Fury, Dressed to Kill, Blowout, Scarface, Body Double, Untouchables, and then one of my very favorite films growing up, Casualties of War.
Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, you know, I was saying it's almost like a roller coaster as well, his kind of career. But yeah, he had this amazing run, I think, through the 80s, through the 70s and 80s, as you say. Yeah, let's go through some. I mean, Sisters. That was his first kind of proper thriller. And it's the first film he really took the kind of Hitchcock approach. He was a massive fan of Hitchcock. I mean, pretty obviously, he's a huge fan of Hitchcock. He studied a lot of film. He really went through the classic filmmaking school, similar to sort of Scorsese and stuff like that. They just watched a lot of movies, watched a lot of classic Americana movies, a lot of European movies, and they got so much influences from all these people, you know, where Scorsese got Powell and Pressburger, and, you know, you can tell De Palma got loads of influences from people. He loved a lot of the French New Wave stuff as well. But Sisters is that one. I mean, he literally took Rear Window. you know, that's what Sisters is, right? I mean, it's all about that kind of voyeuristic thing, looking out the back window and seeing this, was that a murder? Was that not a murder? What's going on? And then nobody believing you kind of thing. All of that stuff. But Sisters is so good. And it's got a kind of viciousness to it. And yet he has this lovely way of playing with you as an observer, with you as a voyeur, doesn't he? He has a brilliant way of just toying with you. And all the way through his filmography, this idea of he'll show you stuff, but it's never quite what it seems, or he'll always be playing with you. And Sisters did that to start off with. I love Sisters. I think it's got some really good performances in it as well. Margot Kidder and people like that.
Oh, my word.
Good.
He's so got good. A knack. Like, we'll talk about casting in this film.
Yeah.
But what a knack for just spotting, like, someone that's going to perfectly encompass the role. It's amazing.
Definitely. So, yeah, I mean, you've got that. And straight away, Sisters did quite well. Very low budget. Did well. He went into Phantom of the Paradise, which is a bizarre one to move into. But again, did quite well. Relatively low budget for what he was trying to do, but did quite well. Obsession after that, it's Vertigo. He starts just taking these ideas. Obsession is essentially Vertigo. A man's wife dies, and then he sees a woman later, you know, after a few years, that resembles her exactly. And there's a whole, I think that's, you know, it doesn't get, people would say he rips stuff off, but ultimately his attitude is, well, I'm only taking an idea that works really well. And the point is, he puts his own stamp on it. He plays with it in his own way. He modernizes it for a start. I mean, Hitchcock in the late 70s was struggling. I mean, he really was. His films at that point in time were all over the place. Mm-hmm. You know, he was really struggling with the idea of modern filmmaking, of how you can depict murders and things like that in a kind of modern way. He was struggling with that. De Palma knew how to do it. He could do it. He could do it with style, and he took these guys, you know, the style of these people, the shots, the ideas, and he then made very modern films at the time, very modern films with them.
That's a great point, Mark, because like Frenzy, it feels like, you know, Hitchcock is back, but it's very derivative of other stuff that he has seen.
Yeah, and you can sense he's trying to make it feel really kind of like vicious, but it kind of has this sort of like slightly, it's not really convincing.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, back in his classic, you know, looking at Psycho or something like that, it almost felt that he wasn't even trying too hard. He just could do it. And he just made these little works of art that were just almost perfect because he was so comfortable within that system. But yeah, he then makes Carrie. And Carrie was essentially on a budget similar to Halloween. It was essentially, you know, we're talking like less than $100,000 type film. It was a really, really low budget. The book, the novel, we all think now, oh, right, he got this, like, it's like Jaws or something. He got this massive selling book and got to make the film of it. But in 1976, when it came out, it had been out for a year or two, it hadn't actually caught on. You know, it was his, you know, Stephen King's first big novel. It took a while to actually build up. And when he sort of started, when he directed it, it wasn't that big a thing. It almost, they kind of happened together in a way, the film and the book becoming that popular. It was almost like an explosion together, and that then leads into him suddenly becoming a bigger director. You got the Fury, he gets Kirk Douglas in, you know, to do this kind of weird, you know, and not, I don't think his greatest film. I think it's a film that you can see he's kind of losing a little bit of momentum, that almost he's kind of maybe tired out a little bit. It doesn't do that well compared to Carrie, you know.
Surprising. And
yeah, I mean, it does okay, but it's not the big hit that everyone's thinking it might be, because this guy coming from Carrie, it's like, all right, here we go. That. We'll give him some money and, you know, some bigger stars, and you're hoping for that big sort of success again. It didn't really do it. Reviews weren't hugely great. Some were good, but some weren't. But he went back to home movies, which you didn't mention, but we mentioned before. He went to this weird comedy thing. And the thing is, by that point in time, he'd married Nancy Allen. Obviously, he'd cast in Carrie.
I did not know that. Mad.
So he was married to Nancy Allen, and he brought in Keith Gordon in that film, and that was them together in home movies. But he then makes Dress to Kill, and he gets a bit of money for it. It's not a big budget movie, though. I think it was around about $10 million, something like that. So it was big-ish, but not what you would classify as like a crazy, you know, big budget movie. He writes the characters specifically for Nancy Allen and Keith Gordon. He has those two people in mind. He writes those characters. Keith Gordon's character, David, is actually based on De Palma. It is his biographical character. The kind of geeky inventor, that's what De Palma was. When he was a kid, he did science fairs, he built computers, he built circuits, he built robots. That's what he loved doing, rather than he went into filmmaking afterwards.
I can see that now, because it's very specific, like one of the scenes where he's outside the police offices, but he wants to hear what's going on, so he gets some wires out, a little earbud and things. It goes into also, a lot of detail that was unnecessary.
Well, the camera, of course. So there's the big bit where he's building the camera that he puts in the back of his bike to spy on the front door. And De Palma did that. De Palma had done that when he was a kid to spy on his dad when his dad was having affairs. He actually built a camera that could spy on his dad so he could prove that he could watch and prove that he's dead. But, you know, the creepy voyeurist thing as well, you know, it's like he was actually building to watch his dad having affairs. It's like, you know, really kind of edgy stuff. But this is the thing. So to me, De Palma has like three kind of styles. To me, he has the comedy kind of weirdo early stuff. Then he has the De Palma big budget Hollywood director. And then he has the De Palma New Jersey, New York, fuck it, I'm going to do whatever I want kind of thing. Yeah. And so to me, when you look through his career, you get to blow out your Scarface, which was, you know, not a big film at the time. It got absolutely slated by critics. Cult movie. Mad, right? Body Double. It was going to be big, crashed. Then Body Double, Wise Guys, Untouchables, you know, wow, all of a sudden, you know, like Oscars and stuff like that, Casualties of War, wow, big movie, big Oscars, Bonfire of the Vanities, massive failure. What did he do after that? Raising Kane. See, to me, you've got these films, you know, you've got Dress to Kill, you've got Blowout, you've got Body Double, Raising Kane. Later on, you've got things like Femme Fatale as well. These little movies that he does in between the big ones, quite often when the big ones don't do as well as they should do. And he does these little ones. And they're the ones that really interest me. Those ones at the bottom, when he just does something he just wants to do. And then does the big budget.
What do you think of Snake Eyes?
I haven't seen Snake Eyes. Do you know why I haven't seen Snake Eyes? This is a load of people are going to be like, fuck you. I don't like Nick Cage. And Nick Cage puts me off films. Like my most hated David Lynch film. You know, it's like, I just can't stand Nick Cage.
That's the best Wild news. Heart.
I can't do it.
In a couple of years, I'll be doing like a Nick Cage special and you'll be on.
I mean, I'm not saying he's not done something decent. I'm not saying he's not, but it's just when I see Nick Cage in a film, it's just, I'm going to see a Nick Cage film. I just feel he's got that whole thing and it's like, really?
I get it, but that's why it's exciting to me.
Yeah, a lot of people are like, a Nick Cage film, great.
he's 80 now. Not Nick Cage, Brian De Palma. But he's still like recently done films, but I haven't seen anything after 98. So,
and he hasn't really done that much. I mean, he did Black Dahlia, which was quite a big sort of movie, but really boring, very kind of dull film, and for a really interesting subject matter as well. And I haven't seen the last three, the Redacted, Passion, and Domino. I haven't seen those ones. They're essentially three he's done in the last 15 years. I haven't seen those. But, you know, I'm not saying he's disappeared. I think it's more just the point of, I think he got a bit tired of a lot of it. He was a guy that really got slated by a lot of people through his career. You know, had to deal with a lot of accusations of just being either thieving and sort of stealing ideas off of, you know, other directors, or just essentially, you know, doing soft porn, or, you know, this incredible misogyny. But it seems that he gets targeted or got targeted by these sort of accusations, I think kind of unfairly, because I think you could have targeted a whole load of other big directors for that kind of thing. I mean, you know, if we're talking about misogyny, I mean, blimey, you know, you're doing a horror podcast. I mean,
sure.
You know, absolutely any of these directors at any point in time, pretty much even now, could still be accused of essentially looking at male violence on females and profiting from it. It's just, that's kind of what we've lived with.
Yes, well, since the beginning of cinema, pretty much. Yeah. It's all
because it's ingrained in culture. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I think to sort of point him out when really Dress to Kill, which was one of the big accusations of it, and it got protests and stuff like that. It's essentially just a giallo in that sense. You know, all he does is he twists the whole idea of, you know, in giallo, you got quite often, like the bird with the crystal plumage, you could compare it very closely to that. And it has the same idea of this sort of real sort of that kind of sort of over the top violence within a sort of crime story, a thriller, but that very sort of targeted at sort of women victims or female victims. But of course, with Argento, a lot of the time, with a lot of the giallo films, a lot of the times the women weren't just the victims, they were quite often the perpetrators as well. And that was quite often the twist and the sort of play with the gender roles, and the males generally were these doofuses that were caught in the middle of it all, just running about like a headless chicken. In a way, Dress to Kill is kind of De Palma's almost playing with that, because the big reveal in this is the kind of, oh, well, it's a woman murdering other women, but it's not. It's a man who wants to be a woman, but can't be. So he's just playing with that gender stereotype as well. But I can't imagine it's not a sense of looking at classic giallo films and thinking, well, because at that time you must have been watching them and thinking, what great stuff. It's all about style and all that. You know, you must have loved it.
There's tons of that stuff. And I'll bring it up right towards the end again, a little point about that. Before we leave De Palma, I just want to talk about his actual execution of the way he employs the split screens in this one.
Yes.
Now, he didn't invent it, but whenever I see it, I always think of De Palma. Just that's what I do now. Yeah. And obviously, he didn't invent that, but he just has a way with it. And I remember Carrie and just being so blown away. Every time I watch it, I'm like, oh, my God, Claire, this is the bit. Now, I get excited, and no one gets me that excited.
Exactly, about showing you what's happening at the front that everyone can see, but then the other side of it is showing what's going on in the background, and you can see both bits. Yeah,
it's exciting.
Exactly.
And I don't think here it's so great. Like, it happens here where there is a scene where Michael Caine's watching Donahue about transsexuals, a program about that, and then Nancy Allen's doing her makeup while watching the same thing, sort of thing. Yes. It doesn't have that same impact for me.
No. You're right. I mean, definitely the split screen. I mean, there are certain things that he used a lot, and he did enjoy, he did love, but he used them so much. I think that's the point you're sort of making. He used them so much, they've become almost, you know, if somebody else uses them a lot, they would be compared to De Palma. You know, if you used a lot of split screen, then suddenly say, oh, like De Palma did, you know, just because. I mean, he also used something called split diopter, which is the thing where you get the two different depth of field for, you know, the two different focus points in one shot, and that's used even more. He used that all the time. It's used in this film a dozen times, maybe more, but that was used a lot as well. Hitchcock used that as well. And the whole point is, it's quite hard to show, you know, two points at distance to each other in the same focus, you know, unless you use a wide angle lens, and then it generally gets lost in everything else. Yeah. But so what you want to do is, if you have a close-up of someone, you generally have a narrow lens, so a zoom in, which puts everything in the background blurry, but what you want to do is just highlight something. And it's got that beautiful sort of thing of, you know, having the reaction of somebody maybe listening to something that's happening in the background, and you can see both things happening, you know, really clearly. It's almost like a split screen, but it works in a different way. Coppola used it a lot as well, I think. Yeah, he used that a lot. Slow motion was the other thing he was accused of using way too much of. He was people would shout at him, you know, critics would throw stuff at him for, like, just this idea of, well, what, you just film something, as soon as you put it in slow motion, what, it means something more, or what, you know, it's just this, it's just something in slow motion. But I don't think so. I think he uses it brilliantly. You know, think of the pram going down the steps in The Untouchables. You know, it's almost funny how long this pram takes to get to the bottom of the steps, but it's brilliantly done. Everyone's kind of looking at each other. It's almost like, you know, Once Upon a Time in the West or something, where everyone's kind of like waiting for the moment where guns get drawn, and it's just, it's great. I love it. But he uses that as well, yeah.
He is, like you say, I don't know what the issue is. When we run down that list of films, of just like, classic after classic after classic.
But even and that's what I'm saying. Even the little ones, I think, are the ones that really that are more fun, more interesting. But the Untouchables, you know, you're just looking, what a perfectly cast film. This is a film you can think of that's more perfectly cast than the Untouchables. Every single role in it is so beautifully cast, even the smaller one. Billy Drago as the assassin, you know, it's like they're just perfect. That's what makes the film for me in lots of ways. It's just they're almost made for that part. Yeah.
Yeah. When you mentioned earlier on that, like, I didn't even realize, like, because I was too young, that it was a film by this director. That was Untouchables and like several others in that canon for me. As I say, when I discovered like one that I truly loved and I went and searched all the others out, I'm like, wow, what a time that is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know,
I want to talk about Michael Caine. Like, what do you think about this casting? I'm still, this is only my second watch of this one, but I'm still on the, I don't know. Is it good? Is it bad? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, well, isn't this sort of Michael Caine? I mean, it was always hard to sort of tell whether this was one of Michael Caine's, yeah, I'll do it for the check. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, he was quite happy to say, you know, what was the quote when was it Jaws the Revenge somebody asked him about? And sort of, you know, said, you know, what do you think about, you know, you did this film and it's like terrible. And he said, I don't really care. It paid my mortgage off. Yeah. You know, that was it. Well, you know, he was always quite sort of open with that. And I was always trying to figure out whether this was one of those movies, but it's not. Sean Connery was actually originally cast to play the part. Whoa. And apparently he was really up for it. He was totally up for it to play this. Imagine Sean Connery built like a
shit. When was Zardo?
Zardos. Oh gosh, that is late 70s, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it was different, but yeah, sometimes he does go for those, like, I'm just
Sean Connery really wished Sean Connery, by, you know, going a bit of a digression, but he really liked the idea of doing much more art house stuff, but he would never get the jobs, you know. So he was, you know, when he did The Offense, which is this kind of amazing kind of low budget thriller that's based on a play, he had to do some James Bond. He had, you know, when he did the thing where he disappeared from James Bond,
yeah,
and then he came back and did some when he was a bit older kind of thing. And the reason he came back was to get the money to then pay for doing the smaller budget stuff that he wanted to do, because he never got that. He was a big, you know, he was James Bond. You're never going to give James Bond these weird little roles, and he was really up for that. But apparently there was like a clash with sort of filming schedules or something like that. So it was like a last minute thing. And De Palma shared an agent with Michael Caine. De Palma's agent was also Michael Caine's agent. And the agent basically said, do you want me to give him a ring? It was all right. And apparently Michael Caine really enjoyed it. Was like really up for it. He was really into it. He said he was like absolutely, you know, totally professional through the whole thing. You know, really enjoyed doing it. And, you know, apparently they had a lot of fun with the sort of the whole idea. He actually never, although you might think he kind of like was through the whole film dressed up as the character, he actually only dressed up once.
Was it the elevator time?
No, that's not him. That's someone else. It's like the only time he actually was in the costume was that last scene when he shot.
Oh,
and it obviously all falls off kind of thing. That's his only time. But apparently, you know, he really loved it. It was there, and he's sort of, De Palma can laugh, you know, sit back and laugh, remember the sort of like what he looked like when he came out in it, because, you know, he didn't look anywhere near as convincing as the earlier ones. And, you know, not that they were particularly convincing.
No, they were not.
What's interesting, you remember in that film as well, if we talk about that particular character, the blonde, Hitchcock again, that's following Nancy Allen's character. So she's getting followed by the blonde. Of course, you've got to remember that the blonde that's following her is actually the policewoman, which kind of gets lost in a lot of it, because, you know, we think that she's, you know, when she's doing the subway thing, which is a great scene, you know, she's going in the set. That person that's following her is actually the cop that's trailing her, that we find out, yeah, that saves her life in the end. Which is quite interesting, because, you know, the whole point is there's this De Palma thing where he's sort of playing you. You're thinking it is one thing, and it's actually not that. And you find out at the end, oh, right. Well, she's like, well, hold on, you know, you were having me followed, so it wasn't even the murder. And he's like, no, it was the other cop. And you're like, what? Even that is playing with you.
I did like that reveal when they're all sitting down. Like, that reveal I did like. Because she is a normal looking person as well. She's not Hollywood beauty. So you can well see how we're getting confused as the audience. Like, oh,
yeah,
you know, like that works out.
You also get right at the beginning, because I was watching it quite closely to see where all these little bits were. Being De Palma, he took from Hitchcock that sort of very Hitchcockian thing where almost every frame has something in it. Every shot, every scene has something going on in it. Even the scenes that don't appear to, you know, street scenes, there's that classic Hitchcock thing of him appearing in every scene. It's almost like the game of playing when you watch a Hitchcock film, looking for the cameo. This one, it had that kind of feel where I was constantly looking out for, you know, the character, the blonde, you know, trying to see where she would appear. And there is when she first goes to, Angie Dickinson first goes to Michael Caine's office. When she goes in, there's a blonde woman going out. But it's clearly a woman in this case, but she's wearing the black coat.
Got it.
And she has the same hair as she's walking out. But it's like, it's not played at all in any kind of like, oh, it's just there. And if you blink and you miss it kind of moment. But, you know, even then, he's just putting something in that you would sort of earlier, you'd be like, oh, when you rewatch it.
Nancy Allen in this. Especially in the scene where she tries to infiltrate the office and sort of does a ruse with Michael Caine.
I know.
As if I'd seen this as a puberty young guy, I would have been like, this is my favorite film. I love this. This is the best thing I've ever seen. Like this whole scene, just even before she starts to strip, like, it's so erotic the use of language.
Definitely,
It's
because he wrote that for his wife. Wrote that part. You're like, come on, son.
When you said that, I was like, putting all that into my head. Like, that is mad. And the fact that it's so believable, like, that she would try and do this as her ruse.
This is the thing. Nancy Allen, I think, took quite a while for me to appreciate, I think, as an actor. I think she's really good in Carrie. And I think in a way that kind of just is because I think she's just well cast as that character. You could just look at her and imagine she probably would be that kind of bully kind of bitch character. That's not too hard to imagine. I think once you get onto these sort of later De Palma's, and particularly Blowout, which still is pretty much my favorite. I think that was kind of in RoboCop as well. You know, you kind of, I'm not quite sure, but I think the more you watch her, I think I actually appreciate her a lot more as an actor. I think she's actually really good. And I think she plays this part in this film really well. Because if you actually look at it, it's a really kind of interesting character because she starts off where you think he's playing with you. You think she's some sort of businesswoman. That's, you know, about to have a meeting with someone. She's talking about stocks and shares to this guy waiting at the elevator. She sees the murderer kind of thing. Gets interviewed by the police who, you know, big shout out to Dennis Franz, the detective, being possibly the most Dennis Franz performance of all time. You know, sleaziest guy on earth, this guy, isn't he? He's like, brilliant. And, you know, him sort of like the big reveal of, oh, right, you're a prostitute. Okay, you know. Mm-hmm. And she does the whole, but the point is he then flips it back again. Yeah, she's a prostitute. And you get that kind of, oh, right, okay, so she's like a prostitute. But then turns out, okay, yeah, she's a prostitute, but she's actually doing it and she's getting good money from it and she's investing the money. And she actually does stocks and shares and she is actually like doing it as a businesswoman. You know, and he flips characters and ideas. And I think she plays it really well because the point is she's totally in control of everything. She does it for a reason. Yeah, it's her job. And the money she gets from it, it's not just like she's some sort of drug-addled prostitute standing on street corners. No, it's her job. And she takes that money, and that money is, she will, you know, that's like any legitimate source of income. That's what she's going to use it, save it. There you go. And it's so well done. And as you say, she then turns it on every now and again to just be that character. And she does it really well.
Yeah. I love
it. At that point, you realize she's that's the point. She is an actor. Yeah, she's an actor as a character.
It's great. Like, I love the way that she hasn't been turned into this stereotype that we would see around this time and later, where, you know, all sex workers, they're they're dirty, they're the wrong, and it's
always money to pay off a drug habit or something like that, which is the classic sort of thing. They're so desperate to do it that that's the only reason you'd ever do it. Again, it's that kind of attitude, isn't it?
So they get that sort of positive aspect right here, and what I don't think they get right, and we're going to skip to the end, if you don't mind. And this very much happens with Psycho as well. So I wonder if he's just like, this is my version of that. Like, what's going on with all the transsexual stuff? Like, why do that? Why do you think it was done in that way?
Right. Well, I mean, I can say, I mean, he has spoken a lot about it in interviews and stuff like that. And the actual interview that was on TV, was it the Dick Cavett one you were saying about, I think? That was an interview he saw at the time when he was writing it. And that gave him the idea of using a character like that. Because De Palma's obviously always been really interested in this idea of doubles, of having split personalities, of having, with sisters, it's the idea of conjoined twins. You know, and the idea of one part of the personality being it's that kind of sort of high school Freudian sort of idea. You know, you've got this sort of one part of the personality is the personable happy side, and the other part is the repressed dark side. You know that he has that in so many of his films. He uses it everywhere, and he loves that kind of thing. And this is another one of those, you know, where he was just interested in this idea of what we say now transgender, at that time transsexual. This idea of a person, this gender dysmorphia, as we now know it to be, once, you know, feeling you're in the wrong body. And he saw this as being a really interesting sort of plot motif in terms of, that's the sort of thing that's really interesting. What if the part of body that wanted to express themselves but was repressed was a violent part as well? But of course, with the fact that we have such a lack of representation, which is the big problem with so many of these things, you get to the point where it's just another one of these representations of transgenderism that is negative, that is, they're all essentially freaks or, you know, psychotic sex murderers. Of course they would be. Why wouldn't they be? You know, I was trying to think of a positive transgender character from that kind of period, 70s, 80s, that I could just spring to mind. I could only think of one, another De Palma connection, actually. John Lithgow in World According to Garp, who plays a transgender character, and she's lovely. I mean, she's probably like the loveliest character in the whole film. I mean, real, just the most emotional character, the one that's the most loving character in it. And I think that's the only one I could think of. Every other example, as you say, Psycho or anything like that, even up into the 80s and 90s, it was like, because there's no representation. So the point is, he might sit there and say, I think he was trying to almost, you know, there's a conversation at the end of the film where they're sort of doing that thing when they're having a chat in the bar, and you've got the lady behind them eavesdropping, and they're talking about gender surgery. Oh. And it's like, it's got this whole kind of like really uncomfortable thing where at the time you probably felt that he was trying to be really edgy with traditional American values and say, no, look, this is, you know, let's really fuck them up, you know, let's play with them, let's really upset them by putting all this in. But it now seems really clunkily sort of cis male sort of castration anxiety type stuff of like, cut the penis off and like, you know, let's say that, because that's like, you know, what could be worse? Let's really freak people out.
You're let
like,
it no. down the middle.
It just seems very old fashioned. That's dated a huge amount now. I think he probably was trying to create some sort of, I think he was trying to do something a bit more positive, but really failed miserably. And I think as time's gone on, it's failed even more.
I would love just a one-off line to fix all that, to say, you know, like, oh, no, this is completely normal. It's just that this guy was a psycho from the beginning, you know, anything like that, just to like maybe smooth a bit of the land.
Yeah.
But we didn't get it.
I don't think there's any way of doing that. I think because that is such a key part of the character, that, you know, is dysmorphia, that two personalities living in one body is too important to the whole thing. You can't get around it. Even if you said, yeah, it was the male part that was the psycho, it's like, well, you're still talking about a person who is you know, dealing with one thing. And it's like, as soon as you introduce that and the fact that they're a murderer, well, you know, you're not really, you can't get around it.
That's it. I remember the first time, which is, as I say, only a year and a bit ago, but I was just like, but he's going to flip this again, because then it goes into another ending. And I just thought, oh, this is all going to be flipped. You've got me. Well done. And no, it didn't.
He just did Carrie as well. And isn't that sort of like typical of him? I do like the way that he's such a kind of agitator. He's such a provocateur in that he really reacts to a lot of the criticisms of his work. And I think he enjoys winding people up, particularly critics up, about his work. So he just took the ending of Carrie and put it in this film as well. I mean, he literally just did it. If you actually look at it, it may as well, but it's the same beats, the same tension, the same feel, you know, the sort of that Vaseline on the lens, focusy type thing that Carrie has. It's, you know, it's all the music as well. Yeah. We haven't spoken about the music, this kind of woozy, melodramatic music, same composer he had since Carrie, you know, this almost, I compare him to sort of Angelo Badalamenti doing David Lynch, you know, this idea of, you know, Twin Peaks with this crazy romantic TV soap opera music with these really horrible kind of ideas and visuals. Made a brilliant contrast. I think it's the same thing as a Pino Donaggio, the composer doing this stuff. Same idea.
It's mad that, like, at the beginning of this film, when we're still with, like, oh my goodness, Keith Gordon and his mum, and like when they're talking, like, he talks about the circuit board and how it will carry the electricity, and then they keep saying the word carry and carry and carry and carry. It's like, all right, we get it. You did carry. You know, well done. It's like,
that's
brilliant. Yeah.
That's so good. Yeah, I know. I just love the fact that he does it, and will. the whole reason he did body double was he got so fucked off with people saying that Dress to Kill was just pornography, it was just softcore pornography. He said, you'd think that was pornography, right? Fuck you, I'm gonna make a fucking porn film. And he does body double, and it's like, you know, he actually, I mean, you know, it's that's the whole thing. You think that's an erotic film, fine, I will do an erotic film. And he just did it to piss off the people that got pissed off that Dress to Kill was a, you know, soft porn film. Fine, here's a soft porn film. And he does the same thing. He does these brilliant plot twists and great sort of camera work and all the rest of it.
Well, I think this film is so good that, like, it was outside my top 10. It's now, on the second watch, crashed into that top 10. Yeah. Before we go, is there anything we've missed out that you feel like people should know about this film?
It's not so much that. I think probably the one thing we haven't discussed too much, apart from the sort of transphobia within it, maybe, I think is the kind of negative things, because it's not a perfect film by any sort of means, although it's, you know, Palmer's, you know, incredibly kind of fun director to watch. You know, his films, I think, are always, at least if nothing else, they're fun to watch. You know, you never quite know what you're going to get. You know, he does, sometimes there is a certain struggle with script. Sometimes there is, you know, this film is not perfect. It is misogynistic. There's no doubt about it. Not necessarily, even more so than a lot. But, you know, it is casually racist through a lot of it as well. And a lot of his work is, you know, has a certain sort of casual racism through it, through that point in time as well. So, you know, it's a film that I think has dated. And I think you would say there would be I think watching it now, it's a very different experience. And that's why I said, I think it's a good film for, you know, the people that would enjoy it the most would be a teenage boy, because I don't think they'd pick up on an awful lot of the concerns, although nowadays they may well do, much more sort of informed teenagers than we would have been. But I think, you know, in those days it would have just been a roller coaster ride and fuck the rest of it. This is great, you know? But it's not a perfect film. I think that's the one thing I would say about.
Well, here's my sort of take on it. I couldn't recommend it, even though I enjoyed this much more than on my first watch. I would say stick with Psycho. And I would also say, for all that cop stuff and that police procedural stuff, I'd go to Italy. There's countless giallos that I think do it as well or better. But I feel like it's a really important film.
That's the thing. You'd be missing out, aren't you? You're missing out as well, though. I think to say to not recommend it, I think it's a good litmus test. I think, you know, particularly if I think you already know, I think a lot of people already know if they're a De Palma guy or, you know, a De Palma guy or girl, you're going to know. But if you're not sure, if maybe you've only seen like The Untouchables or Carrie, things like that, and, you know, there's that idea of some of these lesser known De Palmas that you wouldn't know that much about, this is a pretty good litmus test to see whether, yeah, you should do. Because I think if you watch this and you think, okay, you know, it's problematic, but it's definitely got, you know, this is a lot of fun to watch. I enjoy the twists. I'm enjoying the turns. I'm enjoying the kind of ludicrous set pieces. And, you know, I'm enjoying those 10 minutes exposition dumps in between them kind of thing.
Which
you know?
Are great.
Yeah. You know, it's just, if you're quite happy with that, then you should definitely look out some of the other stuff, because they are gems. You know, they simply are gems. You know, Body Double is, you know, one that took me ages to get round to watching. And I thought, with that front cover and everything, it was like, oh, really? It really was like, kind of, oh, this is like, you know, this is the proper ones. You just didn't take out the DVD, you know, the video shop kind of thing, because, you know, you couldn't take that up to the desk. You know. Yes, it's a quiet night in for me with this one. Yeah, it really is. Yeah. But you actually watch it and it's like, well, this is a cracking film. You know, this is a fun film. This is throwing me all over the place. I don't know what's going on. And, you know, brilliant endings and twists and turns. Great. So I think it's a good litmus test for that. I think if you can get through the problematic stuff, but still really enjoy it, then you've got a lot of really great films to see that you will love.
As a very final thing, I know I've only given you like an hour to think of this, but is there anything that you would pair with this as a double bill?
Well, this was the thing. This one, normally I kind of like sit and struggle over this to try and think what would be a lot of obvious ones. And this one, I was like, wow, yeah, well, of course, there's all sorts of stuff. Psycho would be a really good one. You know, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, any Hitchcock film, frankly, you could have fun just sort of like, but no, I mean, I think he'd like that. He'd want you to sort of watch the Hitchcock next to it and have fun seeing where he's lifted bits from or how he did it differently. But I think, again, I because I'm such a fan of those sort of slightly lesser known De Palmas, I think I'm just going to pick one of those. I'm going to pick Femme Fatale, which is sort of one of the latest ones, 2002.
I've not seen this one.
A lot of people haven't. It's you know, it's just one of those films. He did it after the failure of Mission to Mars. And this is what I'm saying. He did Snake Eyes, Mission to Mars, big Hollywood budget film that absolutely crashed.
Yeah.
Completely crashed and burns. And what does he do? Makes his little Brian De Palma film. And it is classic De Palma. Again, you know, you don't watch it with your mum kind of thing. You know, I mean, really sort of, you know, again, the first 20 minutes are like, okay, where are you taking me on this one? You know, and then, you know, we get, you know, Antonio Banderas comes into it and all of a sudden it's like, what the fuck is going on? Then there's like memory losses and dreams and shit like that. And you're like, what the fuck is this? And it apps. And then you get an ending that just throws you completely 360 degrees round. You don't know what way you're facing, and then it's just one of those films that you're like, unless you knew it was De Palma, you wouldn't touch it. You look at the cover and you would just think no, but you think there's a De Palma film. Okay, I'll give it a go. First 20 minutes, oh god, you know,
here we go,
a bit dodgy, and then it's like, yeah, great. So I would genuinely recommend it if you like your De Palma and you haven't seen that one, it's a cracker.
In all honesty, Mark, I think this is my favourite chat I've had with you. This has been great. Okay. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you.
Well, the only problem that I've got here with Pino Donaggio's score is that it's not very horror. And where many people would say, well, that's okay, this film isn't a horror film, I would say that a lot of that has to do with this, quite frankly, ridiculously lush soundtrack. From the off, with the opening shower scene, this stuff is backed with this slightly sexually charged and romantic and longing ballad. And he achieves this with what sounds like a string quartet. This isn't minimal keyboard stabbing, 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 letting us know exactly what we're in for. This simply glides us through this poised and emotional opening salvo. It's only on those blindingly obvious terror slash horror, thank you very much, moments. For instance, with that brutal elevator kill, that we actually hear Pino truly embellishing on that very much 60s influence horror motif. It's a great shitty problem to have, right? Listening to this thing in full, away from the movie, is so smooth and so relaxing. For the most part, as I said, it just sounds posh. It's elegant and it feels of an era when sort of romance movies were very much the in thing. I love that the twists and the turns in this movie aren't particularly covered by an appropriate score. It adds to this thing's sort of charming opulence. And do I think it would have perhaps served the film better to screech things up and scuzz it all up around the edges? Yeah, yes I do. But would I change what we have in any way? No, I can't say that I would. This is a brilliant work and it's because of that that I'm just going to have to lump it. As I say, what a great problem to have. And you might be asking yourself, well, with that conversation with Mark, it's pretty much spoilt, but I've never seen it and I really would like to watch it. So where can you do that? In the UK, you can stream it for free on MGM via Amazon Prime. And in the USA, I think it's Pluto, Showtime, Hoopla, Tubi and Canopy. That's where to go. I wrote it down on a piece of paper next to my little script here. Fingers crossed, I got that right. As for podcasts, there is a really interesting podcast chat about this film, and it's called the Video Archives Podcast, and that is with Quentin Tarantino. You may have heard of him. He has Eli Roth, again, you may have heard of him, as a guest. Anything after that episode, it sort of pales into insignificance. It's almost 2 hours long. Yeah, it's called the Video Archives. I hadn't heard of it before this. And of course, I'm now going through all the old episodes. And that is your Dress to Kill. Oh, you're cruising, for a bruising. In my number 8 pick, we're going to hit up the complete legend of the screen, Al Pacino himself. A man that alongside Robert De Niro at this time was considered the greatest actor of his generation. And here he is involved in a movie which contains serial murder. It's a slasher. I do not care how you want to declare this one. I have thought about this over the past few weeks and I myself cannot deny its placement in this list. And you may say, well, Paul, hang on, even the director says it's not horror. Well, I would say this. When Friedkin released The Exorcist onto this world, he made it clear that he didn't believe that it was a horror either. And I think now history will tell us that perhaps The Exorcist was the greatest horror movie of all time. It is fair to say for its day, and no thanks in small part to Pacino, that this would have been classed an elevated take on the slasher genre. And it does shy away from the gore, and instead it concentrates on the whos and the whys, much like a competent giallo would. But I just think that this film deserves its placement in the very fringes of horror greats, of the 80s at least, in my eyes. This is Cruising.
Coming to DVD September 2007. From William Friedkin.
We've been finding parts of bodies floating in the river.
Comes a psychological thriller.
Why don't we take a walk?
Starring Academy Award winner Al Pacino.
How'd you like to disappear? Go undercover.
Disappear?
The victim was in about 10 pieces.
He's a bad dude. He's a scumbag.
You made me do that. Where are you?
Things happening to me, you know?
A controversial and landmark film.
Why don't you want me anymore?
What I'm doing is affecting me.
About a New York subculture being terrorized by one of its own.
There's just stuff going down.
You know what you have to do.
Now I'm afraid.
Here's your letterbox synopsis, all about cruising. It says this: Al Pacino is cruising for a killer. A serial killer brutally slays and dismembers several gay men in New York's S&M and leather districts. The young police officer, Steve Burns, is sent undercover onto the streets as a decoy for the murderer. Working almost completely isolated from his department, he has to learn to practice the complex rules and signals of this little society. And to join us today for a chat about this one, it's podcast regular Sir Benjamin Bowles. Ben is the number one contributor to A Year in Horror. Sorry, Mr. Mark Canale, you're lagging behind. You've only been on here 21 times. This is Ben's 25th appearance on the show. And I can say maybe it's not healthy for me to force someone to watch this many horror movies. I think at one point I put him through Nazi exploitation with Love Camp 7. I've also put him through a Cat 3 film with Ebola syndrome. I even shoved a video nasty under his nose in the shape of toxic zombies. Today, Ben, don't worry. The heat is off. This is a sensible film, right? Brilliant. Benjamin Bowles, welcome to the podcast. How you doing? I'm over yours later.
Looking forward to it, Paul. How are you?
It does look like a penis going into my face, doesn't it? My microphone.
It really does. It looks very phallic.
Wonderful. Talking of phallic, what a wonderful film.
What a lovely segue.
Right. Okay. Let's just go bang into this, Ben. Right. We're going to be seeing a lot of each other today anyway, so this is a nice way to kick it off. We're talking about Cruising. It's in my top 10 for 1980. I thoroughly enjoyed it. People would say, well, hang on, this is not a horror. What's it doing there? But I say this. I would say there is a serial killer type film, and it's very Giallo-esque. It's very like that Italian 70s, very late 60s sort of thriller stroke horror that always seems to get labelled as horror. So I'm having it in there.
Interesting. Yeah, because I wouldn't label it as horror. And I was thinking, why is Paul asking me to watch this? I thought it was some kind of sick joke.
I often will just say, Ben, watch this really gay thing.
Yeah, well, why not? Back. I like to think I'm progressive in my thinking, so it certainly didn't put me off. And Al Pacino being in it, that turned me on, if anything.
Did you know this film had existed before I sent it your way yesterday?
No, not at all. And I broke a podcast record, actually. So, you know how my diary management is pretty woeful. Well, I finished watching this. So it's 3 minutes past five now. We came on at five. I finished watching at 4:58.
It's amazing.
Yep.
Mate, how fresh is that?
It is fresh.
Considering you didn't know it existed 2 days ago.
Yeah, I know.
I love it. Were you excited that it had Al fucking Pacino in it?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Pacino. And so yeah, that was the if I'd seen another star, or if I'd known another star was in it, I don't think I'd be that excited. But I hadn't even heard of this film, and knowing Pacino is in it,
and still in
I was quite excited. Yeah, and totally in his prime. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, that was very exciting. So I came to this film with high expectations.
Good, good. Okay. Next question. Did you enjoy it?
Not really.
Not
really. I enjoyed certain part. I tell you the bit that I enjoyed. I enjoyed the really simple nature of the cinematography. A lot of the angles are kind of locked off and just everything happens within the scene. The blocking's really nice. There was an amazing shot that I thought, Jesus, it must have been done before, but I can't remember the last time I've seen it. There's a really nice escalator scene where the chief and Pacino's basically the dialogue starts at the very bottom and it's just a conversation of them coming up, and it was so simple, and there's just a bit of movement because the escalator, it's just really, really nicely done. So I enjoyed that part of it. I thought the dialogue was clunky. I thought the pointy exposition was just ridiculous, and I also thought that despite it being 1 hour 40, which is, we always talk about running times, I found it a bit slow.
Yeah, I can't disagree with anything you just said there. It is clunky, especially the patchwork of weaving the plot together in the latter half of the film. I did start to watch a commentary last night, but I was missing so much of the acting. Like, you don't go to a Pacino film to listen to what bloody Mark Kermode wants to say about it. I want to watch Pacino in his prime acting. And yeah, so I switched it off, unfortunately. So I don't know all the bits and bobs that I would normally know before speaking with you about it, because I just wanted to watch this guy perform. And I think, regardless of all that clunkiness that he's involved with, and because you're, what a perfect word for it, that the patchwork of this thing should be woven far, especially with that running time. You're right. So we should have like a really pristine, oh, this happened next. Oh, we've gone back to there. We can see why that's happened. Bang, there's your ending. Voila, lovely. And what a satisfying thing it is. And I don't think it makes it that. But maybe it's an editing issue. I don't know. Friedkin's a bit of a flipping expert at filmmaking, isn't he? So who knows?
Yeah, but I did a bit of reading on it, and there was production issues. So with the open-ended ending, easy for me to say, there were some thoughts about, because nothing's really tied up, is it? And that can mean one of two things in my opinion. It means that they've had so many production issues, they think, oh, well, let's just keep the ending really open and then people can just, you know, go with it and sort of make up their own story about where the story's going to go next. Or obviously it's intentional, but I don't know. The reading that I've done, no one really has a theory about it, or a really strong theory. And the director has said that, exactly like I just said, he said that he's leaving it up to the audience to decide. And it's a
cop out.
Well, there's a bit of a red flag there. It's a bit of a cop out, isn't it? Potentially. Again, I'm probably in a very good position to talk about William Friedkin's direct things.
I mean, even with The Exorcist, it is open-ended, but the way it does it, it leaves you with so many questions, and then re-watching, it invites you to rewatch and figure it out, and to like, how did that happen? Like, who is it gone into? Did it die? All this sort of stuff. Very intriguing the way it's put together. Not so much here. And you mentioned the production issues. I love the fact that when it was being produced, like, that nobody knew how it was going to end up, of course. So like the queer contingent in New York were not happy with this. Like, the gays were forming protests outside and making as much noise as they can to ruin the production. So the first thing I noticed when I'm like, oh, that's really, why have they done that? Is a couple of the ADR voiceover things. They sound so voiceovered, like, and out of the actual conversation, especially when we're in the bar. Very frustrating. It's really frustrating to, like, oh man, you've, that's such an ADR. Instantly your head will pick it up, especially if you're, I don't know, if you've been watching like as many films as we have, I've forced you to watch recently, like those things really stand out. But I also loved that little story behind it when I was reading about that, and like why they got onto people's backs. And I will put links in the notes. Mm. So if you're interested in that whole aspect of this filming and the production, like it's really long, but it's really interesting because no one knew what this would turn out like. I've got to ask you, Ben, when we hit the gay club, how do you feel about that? Like, I've never seen anything like it in my life. It was like I might as well be watching Alien. You know, it's mad. What did you think of that? Did you feel enveloped in this world? Did it do a good job?
Well, I was somewhat separated from it, I think. I wasn't that engaged. But what I was thinking is, how brave is this crew? And how brave is this director, and how brave was Pacino for taking it on? Because this was 42 years ago, and yeah. You know, society has moved on so much, but back then this was a massive risk for everybody involved, really, because obviously it was controversial at the time, and it continues to presumably be controversial. But yeah, I was just thinking on those scenes, wow, this is so progressive in so many ways. So yeah, I mean, I so rather than thinking about the sort of the world building as well, because I couldn't really, I'm not sure what it was, I just couldn't sort of, I wasn't in the rhythm of the film at all, so the sort of scenes didn't really grab me. But what really did grab me and sort of pulled me through to a certain extent, yeah, is the bravery from, I suppose, the producers as well, and the production companies that really got behind it early on, because it would have been a big risk.
I know United Artists, they initially put this warning. So you go to the cinema to see this, and you will have a warning on there which says that, I can't remember exactly, but it's like, we are not out to attack. The director was not out to attack a whole community or something like that. And like, that's so obvious, isn't it? Like, why? I mean, you watch this film, there is no attacking on gay culture whatsoever. But it was weird how like they just wanted some sort of get out. The production company didn't believe in the film enough to not put that up there.
Right. I would agree. I think if anybody looks bad, I mean, well, if you want to think about the intent of the director in this film, you just need to watch the first 10 minutes, because it's a supposedly heterosexual policeman in the car. And so yeah, that sort of it clearly sets out Friedkin's stall in terms of his opinion on things. He wasn't doing it for the wrong reasons or anything. So yeah, I would say it's sort of the opposite of being sort of negative towards the gay community.
Did you like Al Pacino's dancing?
Well, Al Pacino, I could watch Al Pacino do anything for 90 minutes and I'd be mildly entertained. So yeah, of course, absolute dude, nearly as good as, oh well, I'm thinking of Carlito's Way. Have you seen that?
I have, yeah, I have.
One of my favorite films of all time. It's so good.
Of course.
And one of my favorite scenes is not him dancing, but watching his girlfriend dance with another man. But he's so confident, and he's so comfortable is that in his own skin, and he knows he's Al Pacino. He doesn't need to impress anyone. He just allows it. And anyway, how did we get here? Al Pacino dancing. I'm all for it.
Yeah, I mean, just fueled by poppers and just gradually building up and building up and building up to this frenzied dance. It's so engaging. If you can't engage in the plot of the film, at least watch that. I mean, watch this for that dance scene. It's something else. And I want to mention this gay club is so hedonistic. There is a scene where there is a man that's sort of chained up, and another man is lubing up his whole arm, ready for a fisting. And there's Al Pacino just as this undercover cop, Just looking on. So cool. He looks so absolutely fucking cool as this man. I mean, I'd give him a cuddle.
Yeah. He pulls it off, doesn't he?
Absolutely. My favorite part in this whole film, though, is the way he handles his straight relationship when he goes back home. I love that. And that's what pulls me through this film. Not so much all the, like, inverted commas, horror and serial killer stuff and even all the gay club stuff. What really gets me through is, like, how he goes through the life of being an undercover cop. So he's away for long periods of time. And we see this in a lot of, like, cop dramas and cop thrillers and cop horrors. When someone's undercover, they just change. It changes them. If it's a mafia film, it changes them. They become one of the crew. So I just think it was handled expertly well. And again, it's another reason you've got to come to this film just to watch these certain bits and at least have an opinion of it. I think it's disgusting how the film has just been, like, hidden away sort of thing until Arrow gave it, like, this big boost a few years back when they released it. It's crazy that, like, someone like you, that's quite a learned, like, film nerd, doesn't know about it. It's crazy.
Yeah, no, it is weird, especially because Al Pacino was attached to it as well. I suppose it's, people that have followed his career may have watched it, but there's nothing, there's just no PR about it. I know it's 42 years ago, but there was no, it's never on any lists, apart from this one, of course, for 80s films. It's just sort of forgotten about and pushed to one side, I think.
And for queer cinema as well, you would think, like, with the current surge of, like, queer cinema, queer filmmakers and things like that, this would always be in the conversation. But it, again, it's not so much, which I find just ever so strange. I want to mention Karen Allen again. She is in Raiders of the Lost Ark. She plays the Mrs. And I also want to mention that the only other Al Pacino horror film that I could find, Devil's Advocate. That was it. Okay. Nothing else.
I thought she was very good in this. I thought she was very well. I think if we go back to the role that she was playing, she was very subtle and understated. And I think that it was great direction, actually, because I think in that situation, especially sort of the 80s, it's, I don't know too much about 80s films, but, you know, everything is turned up to 11, isn't it? Potentially. And especially with this kind of film, with a lot of the scenes are turned up to 11. But she was really restrained, actually, and subtle. And I thought, yeah, those scenes were really nice and nicely played by both of them. Well, obviously Pacino was going to nail it. But the last scene where he broke the fourth wall.
Please. What do you make of that, Ben?
Well, I enjoyed it, but I don't know why. And it didn't make any sense. But I still think, oh, well, you know, be brave. You know, why not? But yeah, that whole scene where she was just sort of putting the gear on, I thought that was really clever. So I think the film ended really well. And yeah, just the fact that I would love him to give a definitive answer why Pacino looked into the camera. There must have been an artistic reason for that. Because it's just, obviously, it's just so, so rare.
It's got to be in that commentary. But as I say, I switched off after 20 minutes because I was missing so much of the good stuff. Final thing. Now, you've made it clear that, like, you thought it was all right at best. But can you recommend for today's audiences? Can they pull anything out of it? I totally would. But what about you, Ben?
Yeah, I think it's still absolutely worth watching for, well, like I said, at the very top. Loved the cinematography. And the lensing, and I loved Pacino, obviously. So, and I think it's worth watching. Two quick things before.
Nice, go.
He might have done it more than twice, but I definitely saw two excellent Pacino leans when he just leans on the wall. If anybody has got a cooler lean than Pacino, well, I'd love to see it. Because I can't believe it. He just, how can a man lean so coolly. I just don't get it. And there was, yes, there was one front on lean, which was cracking. And then about three quarters when he was talking to the chief, just before the escalator scene, actually, so you see Pacino from the back and he just leans. It's classic lean action.
I love that that's what you've got from that. There's a good comedy beat in this as well from him, where he wears the wrong handkerchief in the back pocket. So he's got the handkerchief where he's going to give a golden shower. Because he's put it in the wrong pocket. And the guy comes up to him expecting to get this golden shower. And he goes, no, I just want to watch. And he gets a right ribbon from him. Yeah, that was really funny. I think there's a lot to love about this film. And it's only my second watch. I'm two watches deep. And I will watch it again just to find out about that ending. Because that's interesting.
Yeah.
Why the hell did he look at us?
Exactly. Look out for those leans as well.
It's so weird. I love that you pulled out the lean.
It's all in the lean.
Right, okay. Well, we're going to be over soon, Ben, to start a night of drinking and probably pizza.
I'm thinking Domino's.
Fair play. I'm going to have to. The calorie countdown is right off today.
Yeah, it's we're only here for a visit, though, Paul, aren't we? So you know, we start again tomorrow.
All right, mate. All right, sounds good. I'll see you soon.
About 10, 15 minutes.
Thanks for coming on the show, mate.
Lovely.
Lovely. Well, it's dangerous out here tonight, but a fella's gotta Jack Nietzsche composed Cruising. You will no doubt know his work from the non-tubular bell stuff in The Exorcist. He also composed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and also Stand By Me. For my sins, I also recently heard some of his work on this daft as dogshit Demi Moore horror fantasy thing called The Seventh Sign. But for Cruising, there is a stack of punk bands and post-punk stuff. It's all over the shop on this one. And if you want to hear Nietzsche's sort of incidental score, then I think the only place you can do so is on the film itself. I couldn't find it anywhere. So instead, what you just heard was a snippet from the track Spy Boy from the very prolific John Hiatt. Lifted it straight from the soundtrack. Now, I've never heard of John Hiatt before, but when I say prolific, I'm not kidding. I typed his name into Spotify and there is so much back catalogue stuff to go through. Picking through it, I'm going to recommend another thing to you from his early work, an album called Slugline. I love that. It's this sort of new wave record from 1979. It's really Elvis Costello sounding, and it's pretty cool with it. I listened to a couple of his later things as well. I didn't really like those. But back to Spy Boy. This song is like really dirty. It's really grimy. It's sleazy. And of course, it perfectly fits in with some of those scenes from inside the club. And I love that lyric. I see the vampires sucking blood. I hear those dull thuds. I guess it's trick or treat. Really gets you in the horror mood. This is really slow, really dirty stuff right here. It's the sort of thing that makes me think of like a hot, swampy night in New Orleans or something. And this soundtrack, apart from this one, is like full of up-tempo bangers. So this one really makes me feel this film with a big emphasis on the word feel. It's cool. Check him out. John Hiatt. At this point, everyone's probably groaning and going, yeah, John Hiatt, of course. Anyway, where can you watch this film? Well, in the UK, it is not streaming anywhere, but I bought a beautiful Arrow video. It's got incredible special edition features on there. I think I bought the Blu-ray. I think that's all there is at the moment, no 4K. And in the USA, it's available to stream for free on Cinemax only. As for podcasts, I would hit up Girls, Guts and Giallo. They covered cruising on their June 2019 episode. And I'd also have a listen to the Horror Queers channel. When they did their 100th episode, they covered this Al Pacino cracker. November 2020, that was. Yeah, once again, the Horror Queers and Girls, Guts and Giallo. And that is cruising. We'll be back tomorrow for the next exciting instalment of A Year in Horror.